and lived just like a brahmachari. He would take care of the boys. He would make sure all the cooking was done, all the cleaning was done, all the garbage was taken out, and donated money regularly, like all of his salary. So that was the first time there was any kind of steady basis of income for that temple. It was all just kind of makeshift, based on whatever anyone could get at the time. It was based on whoever would donate something, on the strength of just wanting to donate for a carpet or pay the rent that month or buy or give a car, something like that. So his was regular income. So the whole presence of him was a stabilizing factor. He was older, he had a job, he gave money, he was experienced with people, he was a very fatherly figure to all the brahmacharis. He made sure that all the things in the temple that had to run were taken care of. He also would purchase bhoga from the markets. The markets then were in the South San Francisco area. The people in the markets began to know him as Johnny Ananda. And at least there was a fruit marketeer that used to call him that. That person's name was, or the name he went by, was Banana King Louie. He was especially probably marketing these bonita, are they called, those bananas from South America. He liked Jayananda, and when Jayananda went down there, he would really load him up. In fact, I think during some of the Rathiatra periods, he just loaded a whole truck. So one of the unique traits about Jayananda was that he never liked to spend money or waste money by buying exorbitantly priced things. He didn't even like to waste money by buying anything if he didn't have to. So when he went to these fruit markets, he would convince people like Banana King Louie and others to just, especially for the Rathiatra festivals, give everything free of charge. He had a lot of success with this. And he was very dear to everyone. We learned that a devotee is Dira. He's Dira Janapriyo Priyakaro. Like the Goswamis, he's very much adored by all kinds of people, whether they're affluent or on the streets, whether they're sober or drunk, whatever. They have a great appreciation for saintly people. So affluent or destitute, rich or poor, old or young, everyone had this feeling of Jayananda that he was like a father figure, and very, very paternal. That was kind of the overall feeling one had. And he took care of the devotees in the temple just like that, like he was their father and they were all the children of the sons. So then he, shortly thereafter, after he moved in, became the temple president. The temple president before him was a lot older, but he wasn't the same kind of real committed devotee. His name was Haridas. He was initiated by Prabhupada. He met Prabhupada. He was one of the very first people, Westerners, that Prabhupada ever had a conversation with. And he was the one who had the loft where Bhakta David, whose real name was Paul, lived at 105 Bowery Street. That loft was owned by Haridas. So Haridas kind of got Prabhupada started, but then he sort of disappeared. So when we came out to San Francisco, I teamed up with Shamsundar and Gurdas, and we located Haridas, who had been living in Mendocino, California, as an artist, a painter, living by the seaside painting. And he was about 40 then. I mean, he was like really old. He was like ancient by our standards. So he was kind of like coming and going. But Jayananda was different. He was close to 30, but he was like 100% sold out devotee and austere in his habits, very fatherly and dependable, responsible, reliable. Everyone always thought that they could count on him. When I was a householder, without even asking him, he helped find an apartment. I needed to find a place and gave me his car. There was no question of paying for it, which I offered to do. He had a Ford Falcon station wagon. He just sort of, oh, you need a car? Well, yeah, here, take this. And it was, I mean, in those days, I probably didn't think much or even once, what to speak of twice about taking any kind of a thing that was offered. But it's kind of amazing to me now to think that he would do something like that, because I certainly wouldn't have given my only car to anybody in those days. And that was it. I mean, he just didn't have a car except his taxi, so I suppose he got it. But then he gave that job up too. And one of the things that he did was he got involved in the Rathiyatra festivals at a fairly early stage. And just like Indradumna Swami is called the king of Kirtan, Prajayananda earned the title of the king of Rathiyatra. He initiated the New York Rathiyatra and the L.A. Rathiyatra, which turned out to be the biggest one in the Western Hemisphere. So, to go back to the San Francisco, I don't know a lot of details, because he joined in that period, like late 67, late 66, early 67, and then I left for England in August of 1968, so, and I didn't spend a whole lot of time with him, but the next thing he did that, well, it's kind of like a strange chronology, because people like Jayananda tend to become more renowned after they've departed. So I learned some things about him long after I went to England. And I met a couple of people that met him. One was when I was in England, and I was taking a train out to Gatwick Airport one day, and this very tall, bearded fellow was kind of making some small talk with him. Where are you going? I'm going to the airport. Where are you going? Oh, I'm flying to somewhere, and in America. And then he just kind of got to talking, and then asked him what he did at some point, and he said he worked on a ship where, well, it was in Denmark someplace. And he was a shipbuilder of some kind. Anyway, his name was Bhadrasena, it turned out, that he was initiated by Prabhupada. And he knew Jayananda, and he worked on the Rathiyatra carts. And then the whole conversation just went to Jayananda. Here's this tall guy with the beard, you know, and standing on the platform at Gatwick Railway Station in London. And I guess it was Victoria going to Gatwick. That's where I met him. So I think we rode the train out together. And I think he had a flight too, but it was a different flight. He was going to America that day. And I asked him what he was going to do. And well, what he did, he was a shipbuilder. And I said, it'd really be nice to keep in touch with you. And then, you know, when the train landed in Gatwick, we had to go separate ways. So then I got his number somehow. And said, you know, Jayananda, if he ever gets, you know, he'd like to talk to you at some point. And then it was some time after that. I mean, it must have been a few years. I had kept his number, and Jayananda had come to Los Angeles, and this was after he'd been sick. I had moved from London back to L.A. It was in 1976, and he moved into the temple in Los Angeles because he had this leukemia, and the doctors kept saying he only had, didn't have any time to live. They just kept saying, you know, he should have been dead years ago or weeks ago. But somehow he just lived on for about a year after they said that he should have left. So he was down in Tijuana getting some treatment, and that didn't really do anything. So then this idea, then he came up to L.A., and then we thought, well, just stay in L.A. And we got him a nice hospital bed and an apartment, and he just stayed there, and that's where he left his body. So he came there in 70, what year would it have been? No. It was later than that. It was the first Rathiyatra in L.A. I think it was 1983. So he must have come around about 82. So he would stay there, and then he got talking about this Bhadrasena. I mean, I met him, and we sort of renewed acquaintances, and then we got talking about this guy that I met who was a shipbuilder in Denmark. He'd been living on ships for a long time, and he had come back to the States, and since I mentioned the giant, I said, oh, Bhadrasena, yeah, geez, we gotta get him back, yeah. It's really important. Can you just get in touch with him? So I somehow managed to track him down, and he was working in a gas station in Newport Beach, California, puffing gas. So Jayanand insisted that we go see. Well, I first asked him to come up, and he was too busy, couldn't come, and sounded kind of distracted. And then said, "Well," and then he wasn't going to come up, so I asked him if we could go down and see him. He said, "Yeah." I said, "I might be kind of busy, but you can come down to the place for work." You know, I think it wasn't even an invitation to come to see him in his house, but Jayanand was so keen on going down there, so we decided to go down. And whenever he used to drive from Los Angeles down to Laguna Beach or San Diego, but especially Laguna Beach, I could hardly ever make it because I'd get overcome with the... Well, I didn't have any cars that had air conditioning, and there was so much carbon monoxide on that freeway that I'd always have to pull over and rest somewhere, even after driving like half an hour. I just could never drive it for some reason. I mean, if there was another person that would keep me awake or could help with the driving, I could do it, but it was just a hellish ride. It's just such a horrible drive. You have to have an air-conditioned car, I think, to keep the carbon monoxide out. Anyway... he had this leukemia, and he was bedridden. And about half an hour, you know, as usual, I just started to conk out. I said, "John, I got to pull over. I can't do it. You know, I just can't stay awake. Nothing you'll say can make me stay awake." So he said, "Oh, that's all right." He said, "I'll just drive." And he insisted on driving, even though he had leukemia. So and it was a fairly old car that I had at the time. It was a not a Ford, but one of the cars in the Ford family. I can't remember what it was. It was pretty beat up. I mean, it was an old car. And it wasn't air-conditioned. And it was a stick shift. So he just got in and drove. And I was amazed. I thought, "God, what am I doing? You know, so offensive." So he drove down to this place. And it was Newport Beach, which is near Laguna. And we found this gas station. And there he was, you know, sure enough. Pumping gas, and then Jayananda got out, and I don't think he told him anything about that he was sick or anything. They just had this long conversation between pumping gas. He would come over and talk to him. So I just figured I wouldn't, you know, I just kind of lowball it and not get involved. I figured they had a lot to talk about because he used to help them build the Rath Yatra cars, and if anyone could convince him to be a little bit more Krishna conscious or involved in Krishna consciousness, or in the movement, that it would be Jayananda. So it was probably about an hour of off and on talking. And then he got back in the car, and it was time to head back, and we said goodbye to Bhadrasena. And he was just kind of like sad on the way back, that, you know, he wasn't really going to make any moves to be more Krishna conscious or to come back or anything. And I just didn't, it was kind of like sad, but on the other hand, it was like we just have to move on, and, you know, we can't expect everybody to be Krishna conscious. And it was, I felt really kind of like bad. I made him drive all the way down there, and in one sense, nothing came of it. But he was sad in the beginning, and then he just, you know, just got into chanting and felt kind of satisfied that, you know, we did our duty. He did his duty. He went down there to see him and got a chance to preach to him, and I don't know what's become of him since then. But that was just, you know, something that happened years after the fact. Anyway, it's a, you know, you could write a, I think somebody's writing a book about Jayananda, Dasarath Sutta or somebody. It's really a, huh?
He's trying to.
Yeah, I don't know how far he's gotten, but he's doing it, doing something. And, you know, it's one of those things that just keeps unfolding more incidents about his life. I'll just tell one more thing, and then, because I guess it's getting late. But I was in a, this was after he passed away, and I was driving out to Topanga Canyon, and was in a little store. I had to go to see Nisringananda, and on the way there I stopped in a little store to get some milk or something. It was just almost there. It's the last store before you get out to where Nisringananda lives. And while I was in the store, it's a little tiny place, a little market. There was a guy that I thought was stalking me or something. He was drunk. I could smell his you know, whiskey or wine. His, you know, I just didn't want to really even look at him. He was a tall guy, also had a beard. And, you know, so I just kind of went about my business and pretended that I didn't notice him. And I was getting rung up, and I had the package under my arm. And I was just walking out the door, and then I heard this voice right behind me say, "Hey, did you ever know a guy named Jayananda?" And it was the guy. It was this tall guy who was drunk. And I said, "Yeah." I was really surprised. And he said, where is he? What's he doing? And I said, "Well, he passed away." And he just looked so hurt, so shocked. Like, I couldn't have said anything worse in the world. He almost looked like he was going to start crying. And he just looked down. I said, how did you know him? And he said, oh, I knew him. And I said, well, how? Where? And he just kind of shook his head and he said, you know, he was the nicest guy I ever knew. Nicest guy I ever knew. And then he told that he was in San Francisco once, and this Sankirtan party came down to Fisherman's Wharf. And he was down there kind of watching him. And I guess he'd been drinking then, too. And Sanat Jayananda came up to him and started preaching to him, giving him a book and giving him some cards and telling him to come to the temple. And then this is his description of it. He said that, because I could never confirm this because Jayananda had left, but he said that he liked what he heard and it was real nice, but you know, he had a drinking problem and he didn't really know if he could live like these guys. And he said, well, why don't you just come back with me and I'll give you a job. He said, I can't pay you, but I'll give you a room and board, and we're building something. And he said, what are you building? He said, we're building this cart. It was the Ratha-yatra cart. So he said, oh, I thought, you know, it can't be that hard to do, just build a cart, you know, just take a couple of days. So he agreed, and he thought, and he said, but one thing is, he said, you can't drink while you're building this cart. And he said, there can't be any drinking, and you know, we live kind of simple. We'll just give you room and board, but you know, there's no drinking, and we don't eat meat, and we don't smoke, you know, like that. And so he told him all the rules, and he kind of reluctantly agreed because he was a bit destitute, I guess. Probably didn't have a place to stay or anything. So they got to the temple. And he said, where are we going to work? So they said, well, I'll show you. And it was at the San Francisco Temple on Frederick Street. So they walked around behind the building where the carts were being built in this parking lot. And he said, when I saw this cart, I was just amazed. I thought it was going to be some little tiny thing. And it was like this huge thing that I just couldn't imagine how it would even start to build it. But he was a carpenter. And that's why Jayananda kind of eyed him. He mentioned he was a carpenter with a drinking problem. So that's all he needed to know. He said as long as he was gonna not drink and participate. So he stayed there at the temple for the length of time that the Ratha-yatra cart was built. And to him, Jayananda was just like his father, and got him off his drinking and built the carts. And then he just kind of went back into the world of alcohol and hadn't come out of it when I saw him. Anyway.
But you remember?
Yeah, very, very clearly remembered. It was just an amazing encounter. I mean, I didn't really quite know what to make of it. I was actually kind of frightened. It's just like this big hulking guy with, you know, with alcohol on his breath. But anyway, Jayananda, apparently he used to engage a lot of people like that. They would just come walking along and he needed help and he would befriend them and they would get into doing some service, some devotional service.
Anything else you'd like to speak
about? Maybe you have to prompt me. I can't think of anything. Well, I'd like to say that I'm very honored to be here, and it's actually very inspiring for me, who's, you know, a quote sannyasi, end quote. And he's telling me I have to carry the danda everywhere now I go. But to come into a home where the whole family is so inspired about their Krishna consciousness. We were talking about it today during class, how much danger there is that one can get dissuaded and derailed in Krishna consciousness by being too much intimately connected with the secular world. And you know, I find that that's very true, even for people living in the temple, because, you know, the impetus that Prabhupada gave was you have to go out and preach. Otherwise, there's no point in being in a temple. If you don't preach, if you're not totally immersed in the preaching spirit, then there's no point. You might as well not live in the temple. So I feel very inspired to come in this so-called renounced order of life and see family like yours, where everybody, you know, has a kind of a place, you know, in the world, but the real goal is to be fully Krishna conscious and to go back to the spiritual world. And I always try to preach that as much as I can, that Lord Chaitanya's followers, Lord Chaitanya didn't start a temple, not one. We're all, not all, but mostly householders who had jobs. And these were the great saints that we we follow in the Chaitanya Chaitamrita that we read about. And it's in the future of the Krishna consciousness movement. It is the way, the road ahead, so to speak, that families will lead the way, that they will show that we have an agenda for social change and that they're part of it. Whereas the temples are, you know, kind of renunciants and we are and we aren't. But it's very inspiring to come. And I mean, each time, this has been the second time I've come, and, you know, get a little deeper sense of how committed everybody is to their spiritual lives. It's just, you know, very... it's also inspiring to know that in relation to Srila Prabhupada, how he was so powerful that he inspired something so wonderful as this to happen, to affect a big change in the world, to show that you don't have to live in a temple, and soon there won't be but maybe 5% of the devotees living in a temple. So that's also, you know, gives a greater appreciation of Prabhupada's power and mission and renunciation.
You know, I heard a 1966 tape on 26 Second Avenue. Prabhupada said, "It's not that you all have to come and live with us." He started with not that you all. You said, "Krishna's, you can have him in your home. He will come in your home. You don't have to go to the Himalayas." But you can have him in your home with your friends. You can get together in front of the picture of Krishna, chant Hare Krishna, offer your food to Krishna. In this way, just like that. Very, very enthusiastic.
Yeah, it's interesting. The Prabhupada was preaching that right from the very beginning. Right. And yet, people always took us to be only monastic, exclusively monastic. But that's not what Prabhupada was preaching. He wanted to build that kind of a central focus and core. But at the same time, he was always preaching in public. He even asked some devotees to make Radha Krishna deities, and they should be in every home. They should be placed in every home with a little instruction book explaining how to worship them. And he said, even if you have to put a paper in there that says, if you just pray to these dolls to give you anything you want, they will give it to you. He said, put it in even whatever it takes. Just, it was kind of in a joking way, but somehow or other, get people to have these deities in their house. Yeah. I was going to mention too that Bhakti Chhru made as you probably heard about it, launched a TV series. Mm-hmm. So we're hoping to get that aired on Channel 56 on Sunday night. I mean, a couple of people are looking into it. Do you have the ISKCON World Reviews there? I brought you a couple of these this is a new issue for your reading pleasure. It's a particularly good issue, I think. It's got some good things.
Well, I know that you very kindly spoke about the householder ashram, but without the inspiration of the same percent absorbed, no house, no home responsibilities or anything like that, it would be very difficult. It's like the source of inspiration. Seeing someone in the renounced order is very inspiring.
Well, I think Prabhupada set up a whole system so that we could help each other develop. People are kind of scared of renunciants. I mean, you know, most people, it's a little frightening. They can't identify and understand and think that they could move in that direction. They could be like that. Whereas if you've got a family, a job, a household, and a community that you're involved with, then they think, well, that's something I can do. So that's the advantage of that position. It's a big advantage. I don't know if you probably have this. This is a single volume, Every Well Wisher. Anyway, this is another little gift. You've probably got all six volumes in you. Everyone's probably read them all, but this is a real nice one.
That's great, thank you. I saw in the school I go to, they have a very small library for students, and they have, I was the only student they accepted who's so far as Hare Krishna devotee. It's mostly other denominations, some Jewish people, some a lot of Catholics and Christians.
You might have been the only one that applied.
So, right, the only one that applied, I think, too. Although there is another quote-unquote Hindu, Dilasini Balakrishna, Western-born, and she's been to our Potomac temple.
Oh,
yeah. Janmashtami. She's married to an Indian gentleman. She spent several years in India.
She's Indian or American?
She's American. She studied under a Swami, Chinmayananda. And she's also a student there. But I went into the library, and one day I was having some difficulty or doubts, and is this what I should be doing, whatever. And then all of a sudden I saw that there was a science of self-realization in the library there somehow or other. And you wrote the introduction, I think, too.
Yeah.
It was very nice. I read the introduction and then read some of what Prabhupada said, and it was very supportive.
That's great.
To see how infiltrative, you don't know where things will show up.
Yeah, especially books.
Books show up.
Yeah. That's fantastic.
Thank you. This is nice and small volume. It's easily read. Sometimes.
Yeah, it's very well written and condensed, too.
Nice. Go upstairs. Is there some prasad in there? Yeah?
Yep.
Ready for a little prasad?
That's ready.
Okay. But unless there's something else more?
I don't think so.
It's cottage, so.
Yeah.
Some food, you know.
Oh, that's great. Light. Okay. Lightweight. Okay.
And thanks to everybody.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And tomorrow night you also? No. That'd be nice.
Is there
every night.
But, are you having some program tomorrow night?
No. Are you having a program? I'm sure you are.
We usually have something in the temple every Saturday.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we were going to. I hope we can.